Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford and Leo Laporte, episode number 30 for Friday, January 15th, 2010. Neuropsychopharmacology. It's trippy medicine.
Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to squarespace.com. Use the coupon code Kiki.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Kiki Science Hour, episode number 30 with Dr. Kiki Sanford and Leo Laporte.
Hello.
Hello. And today we are talking about psychedelic drugs. We're talking about research on psychedelic drugs. Didn't know that was still going on. Thought that was something just left in the 60s. Nope. It's here and now, and there's a lot of really interesting research happening. So today we are going to be talking with UC Berkeley's Matthew Baggett. He is a PhD candidate, although he's been working on psychedelic research and these drugs for the past 10 years. So he has a wealth of knowledge, and I'm really looking forward to speaking with him today. He works at the Helen Wills Neuroscience Institute at the University of California, Berkeley. He's interested in the mechanisms and effects of MDMA, otherwise known as methylene diethyl methamphetamine.
It's ecstasy.
Ecstasy, yes. Huh. Party drug ecstasy.
I didn't realize ecstasy had any benefits.
We will hear about those. Yes.
That's
See,
interesting.
This is these are the conceptions that people have. Do these drugs have any benefits?
I just thought that was a recreational drug, but well, this is good. We'll find out.
It's recreation. Is that good for you? We'll find out. He's also
if we get into that, that's a whole nother matter entirely.
Yeah, he's also interested in hallucinogens and what these pharmacological tools can tell us about the working of the brain and consciousness. And his ongoing research includes measuring the cognitive, social, and emotional consequences of taking MDMA, LSD, and methamphetamines in humans. So we'll bring Matthew in just a moment.
Yes, but before we do, I do want to mention our friends at Squarespace.com. This is that incredible place where you can set up a website. I used to say blog, and it's really so much more than a blogging engine. Squarespace is hosting, plus the best, most interesting software I've ever seen for setting up a website. Try it. Go right now to squarespace.com/twit and take a look at it. It is a fully hosted, they say, completely managed environment for creating and managing a website, blog, or portfolio. But that just scratches the surface. There's an iPhone app that's the most amazing app for posting content. It imports seamlessly from most blog engines, including WordPress, TypePad, Blogger. Social integration with YouTube, Dig, Twitter, Facebook, automatically. Incredible templates that just look gorgeous. Stats that'll blow your mind. Probably the easiest ever form editing and designing too. You get this great Ajax designing that makes you just so sweet. I want you to give it a try. Free, no credit card needed. Just go to squarespace.com/twit and take a look at what Squarespace can do for you. We have a Squarespace blog ourselves, the Inside Twit blog. If you go to inside.twit.tv is a Squarespace blog, and we're working with Squarespace to redo the entire Tech Guy site. You should use Squarespace. Do you use Squarespace yet?
I do not use Squarespace yet, but it is something that I am definitely interested in. I do have the need to put together a portfolio site.
Perfect.
I have a need. So Squarespace might be the kind of
thing.
I'll
hook you up, baby.
That would be great.
I'll get you 2 weeks free.
I haven't used it myself. I did a thanks for that. 2 week free trial.
Aren't I generous?
You're so generous. I did suggest to my sister-in-law that she give it a go for her own work blog.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've been spreading the word because I actually, even though I haven't used it myself. I haven't had the time to actually start putting it together myself, but I know people who have needed something and I've sent them to Squarespace.
Well, I'll give you an example of people who use Squarespace. Dane Cook does. Jamie Kennedy does. The Totally Rad Show is all on Squarespace. And this just gives you an idea of the flexibility of Squarespace. Gorgeous sites, easily designed, better yet, easily maintained. Try them right now, squarespace.com/twit. And we thank them so much for their support of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, squarespace.com/twit.
Thank you very much.
I'm ready to talk to Matthew. I think I got him on the line.
Hi, Matt. It's nice to have you on the show.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
So I want to just add one other thing to what the very nice introduction you gave, okay, which is that a lot of the research that I'm doing is actually carried out at California Pacific Medical Center Research Institute in collaboration with John Mendelson and Gant Galloway and the good folks there.
Great. And, and John
shout
Mendelson.
Shout out to those people.
Yeah, give him a good shout out. I actually worked with John Mendelson when I was doing research in his laboratory, his neuropsychopharmacology laboratory at UCSF. So I know that he does some really, really great work into these substances and has been for some time.
MK Ultra, wasn't that the name of the CIA's top secret psychedelic research back in the 50s and 60s?
I have no idea.
As an old stoner hippie, I seem to remember. And in fact, wasn't that how Tim Leary? Yeah, they do say that. If only people who didn't live in the 60s actually remember the 60s.
Right.
I believe Tim Leary got into LSD, as did Richard Alpert, Baba Ram Dass, because they were at Harvard and were involved in those studies. Am I right, Matthew? Does that ring a bell or am I crazy?
He's rubbing his chin.
Well, absolutely. MK Ultra was a top secret CIA program, and they were interested in coming up with better ways to interrogate people and also avoid giving up information if our agents were interrogated.
Right.
And they definitely tested LSD, often in very sketchy ways that we would consider unethical today. And
right,
I think were probably even considered unethical at that time.
That's why it's so secret.
But they did it anyway. Yeah.
Absolutely. As we know, the CIA is often not bound by the normal ethics that many of us consider proper.
But at that point, I think in the 60s, there was a lot of research. I know Cary Grant took LSD, I think, as part of some psychedelic research. And he was a big advocate for LSD use.
Cary Grant.
Yeah. And then it became kind of deprecated. I thought that for a while, maybe because it became illegal, research stopped. I'm actually surprised to hear that research continues on psychedelic drugs.
Yeah, I think that's a major point, that research did stop for a while, but it's come back in force.
Absolutely. It became very difficult to do for a while, and it technically wasn't really banned. It's just that the paperwork was very difficult to fill out, and it was hard to get approval. And there was still some research that went on in Europe during this time period and a little bit in the United States. But I think in the last decade or so, we've really entered what's probably a second golden age of psychedelic research, where psychedelic research is now something that can be done scientifically, legally, and respectably, and we're really starting to learn a lot from it.
Is it appropriate to lump it all together into the same? I mean, doesn't MDMA do something very different than LSD, something very different, say, than, I don't know, other psychotropics, or is it all kind of the same thing?
Oh, absolutely. There's huge differences here. And in some ways, the term psychedelic is just a catch-all for a bunch of drugs that make you feel like you're not yourself in some way.
Right.
And they don't necessarily have the same pharmacological mechanisms. They're not necessarily doing the same things in the brain. And they don't necessarily have the same effects. And so there are really big differences between something like LSD, which is often really quite scary, and mm-hmm. something like MDMA, which is pretty consistent in how it affects people, where people tend to feel very safe and open and close to other people and emotional. And then there's some things that are kind of on the edge, like THC, the active ingredient in cannabis, marijuana, that sometimes people might talk about as if it were a psychedelic, but other times maybe not. And so these are kind of fuzzy categories in some ways.
I think that's a really, really interesting point, that there is some kind of fuzziness in how you define the different drugs and their effects on people and the actual, I guess, psychological effects are going to be, are going to sometimes have a lot of overlaying on each other.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Exactly. We're making categories in order to highlight differences or similarities between drugs, but the categories only really exist to clarify these things.
So which drugs do you study, Matthew?
I've been doing research with MDMA and more recently MDA, and I've done a little bit of other work with some other compounds, including something called Salvinorin A, which is in Salvia divinorum, which is a plant that's only illegal in some states right now. But most of the research has been focused on MDMA and trying to understand what exactly that's doing to people, what it feels like, what its effects are.
Has the research mostly stemmed from the National Institutes on Drug Abuse and money from say the war on drugs? Is that where most of the research comes from, or is it really funded in terms of finding out how these drugs work and how the brain works?
Well, dollar for dollar, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which is part of the NIH, has almost certainly spent more money trying to understand MDMA and other psychedelics than anyone else. But the process by which that money gets allocated is something where I might have an idea where I want to study a certain topic, and so I'll write up a grant and I'll apply for money. And the process by which you get money isn't necessarily that political. And so it's peer-reviewed, so a committee of other scientists will look at your proposal and make certain it has scientific merit. And so just because something is funded by the government, it doesn't necessarily mean you can make any suppositions about some point of view or some point it's trying to prove.
Kiki, you worked in this field.
I did.
And it was NIH, was it?
It was NIDA-funded, NIH-funded, and there were some other sources of funding when I was working as well, but...
It's, you know, I have to, okay, I'm going to speak.
Most of the studies that I was involved in were actually studies working on.
It's about abuse,
Finding treatments for drugs of abuse. Right. So cocaine and heroin and possible treatments for users.
Matthew, is your research about the therapeutic use of MDA and MDMA?
No, it's more basic research, just trying to understand the
how
effects
it works,
of these drugs.
What it does. Mm-hmm.
How it works, what it, exactly.
Yeah.
And some of the things that we're learning, I think, have implications for how one might want to go about doing treatment with these drugs. But it's not at all focused on that. In some ways, I think we need to spend as much time trying to understand how to make these things safe or to understand their consequences as we spend time on things like what their benefits might be. I leave the research on the benefits up to other people, and I worry about the problems that these drugs might cause.
Just so that we're responsible in this conversation, mm-hmm. before we get into that, and I think that's a great conversation, mm-hmm. should we address, first of all, it's illegal. Second of all, should we address, are there health risks associated with the use of MDA and MDMA?
Yeah, I think that's a question that we want to get to, because I think there's a lot. There are some research studies that that Matt's been involved in that we can.
That we don't imply somehow that this is some magical thing that everybody should try.
And that's not the direction that I want to go at all. That's not
leave
the direction
it to you,
that
then,
we're
then.
Going. I think before we get into the actual study results and what we know now about these various drugs, I really want to talk about how you actually go about studying it, and so that we don't make any assumptions on, hey, you're just giving lots of drugs to people and it's, you know, a crazy old time in the laboratory. Could you give us an idea of the process that research on these kinds of drugs, human subjects, has to go through?
Absolutely. So imagine somebody gives you, say, $200,000 or something in that ballpark, and you want to do a clinical study because that's what it would take to do a cheap one. You would need to go through this very long approval process. First of all, you would need to get approval from some local ethics committee that makes certain that the ideas you have for the research, once you implement them, aren't going to injure people involved in it. And so it's really important to minimize the risks to participants. And so we first get approval from what we call an IRB, an institutional review board, that's concerned with the ethics of the research. having gotten that approval, and because we, in our studies, do research often in a hospital or in a clinical setting like that, we have to frequently get approval from several of these committees crossing different institutional boundaries. So we get approval from these committees. Having done that, we also need to get approval from the DEA to handle these drugs. And
right,
approval from the.
Where do your drugs come from? You have to you have to get the drugs from somewhere, or you have to create them in the laboratory, right?
Exactly, and it varies. We are lucky enough to have synthetic chemists that we work with who can make some of these drugs, and the process of making a drug for human administration is also very heavily regulated by the FDA. So we would get approval for the study and at the same time explain to them how we intend to make it and what the steps are to ensure that it's pure. And so we get FDA approval and we get DEA approval. And the DEA is primarily concerned with the drugs not being lost or diverted or going missing.
Right.
And so they require that you have certain types of security procedures. You have safes with alarms and all sorts of things like that. And here in the state of California, we also have to get approval from the state of California as well. So there's at minimum four different regulatory agencies that are looking at what you're doing if you want to consider this sort of research.
Yeah.
And the overall consideration in this sort of research is that you are minimizing harms to participants and that what you're doing is being done in the safest way possible and that you're really closely looking for any kinds of problems so that you can detect them as quickly as possible and respond to them. And so we do research in a hospital setting where there's a physician that's there who's monitoring the situation. And so far things have been fairly safe and we've been able to learn a lot, but these aren't substances that should be taken lightly. Or just because one can do research safely doesn't mean that they're in all cases safe.
Right. So there's a lot of the bottom line here is that there's a ton of regulation that goes into any one of these studies that you undertake, and that the safety of the people who are in the study, who volunteer for these studies, is of the highest concern.
Absolutely.
So moving forward from how the research takes place, What are you finding out? So MDMA, we can start with that one. It's ecstasy. A lot of people have probably heard of people dying from ecstasy overdoses or overheating or drinking too much water. Or there's been news that it's a highly dangerous drug. It causes brain damage. What do we know? Is there a difference between what has come out in the headlines in the popular media and what scientists actually know about it?
What we know about it is that it has robust physical effects in terms of raising heart rate and blood pressure.
Robust physical effects. That's good.
I don't think people would take it if it didn't.
Well, I think they would. I mean, what people are taking it for is the psychological effects, the emotional effects.
Okay, so you're talking about heart rate and
exactly.
Respiration as opposed to seeing purple elephants or whatever it is. Right.
Absolutely. And so if you give MDMA to somebody in an active dose, something that'll affect their consciousness, you can also expect heart rate and blood pressure to go up a lot. Oh. Now, it's something that's the level of moderate exercise, which would generally be something that's not a problem in a healthy person, but maybe in somebody who has heart problems or other problems with their vascular system, this might be a problem.
Yeah.
So you would expect to see these sorts of physical effects. In some people, there's the potential for their body temperature to rise. And this has been something that's been a problem in people who are using it illicitly in non-medical settings, where the body temperature goes up to dangerous levels, which can cause breakdown of proteins and kidney failure and all sorts of bad things. Now, this is something that's relatively rare. If you had to guess how often this happens, it's like much less than 1 in 10,000 times. And it's something that's probably related to exercise and people being overactive and maybe becoming dehydrated so they can't lose heat through sweat.
Yeah.
But what's happened is that because people have heard about this, there's been a lot of information on how people should avoid becoming dehydrated. And as a result, people have been very good about drinking water, which creates a new problem, particularly in women, something called hyponatremia, which is if you drink too much water that has no salts in it, so if it's like water and not some sort of sports drink, then the salts in your blood can get lower than normal. And this can be quite dangerous, actually. Yeah. It's something that also happens in people who run marathons as well if they're drinking just pure water.
Or do and contests for radio stations.
Exactly. Right. So, yeah. Yes, there's not been some good deaths related with this.
Yeah.
And so what this can do is cause your brain cells to swell up and stop working, leading to confusion, irritability, agitation, and in bad situations, if it's left untreated, you can go into a coma and you can die. And so this is something that predominantly affects women, and it's something that happens with relatively low doses of MDMA. And so we've been trying to understand what the mechanism is.
Yeah.
One possibility is that MDMA is causing antidiuretic hormone to be released in the body. So it's the signal that your body would normally make if you're becoming dehydrated in order to retain more water. But in the case of MDMA, MDMA might be causing this signal to be inappropriately turned on, making your body retain more fluids. And so that's one possibility. And although it also seems like something else is happening, because in our past study where we tried to look at this, we weren't able to see really robust increases in this antidiuretic hormone, and we saw increases in how much urine people produced. So they're not necessarily retaining more fluid. So this is still something that's a little mysterious. Mm. But it's one of the things that's one of the major ways that people on MDMA die. And yeah. Again, I want to emphasize that these sorts of risks are rare and low, but because when they do happen, they're serious, I think it's important to understand them.
What are the roadblocks to being able to understand them? Is it, is it just being able to access the, can you just take blood samples, urine samples whilst in the laboratory, while somebody's been given a low dose to see how they respond? Or is it because it's such a rare occurrence, you just don't see the changes that might occur in one individual, but not in the majority?
Yeah, so what we tend to do is we give safe doses of MDMA in a setting that's very safe, and we see little changes. And from that, we try to infer what might happen in other situations where people are taking higher doses or where you're seeing more exaggerated responses to the drug. And so we're kind of trying to infer what might be going on, but we don't necessarily actually see hyponatremia in our studies. And so So that's essentially it, and research proceeds slowly. So this is on the sort of physiological side of things
of
what we're looking at. But another big interest of mine is the emotional side of things and trying to understand what MDMA is doing emotionally, because there's been reports for decades now that MDMA has really unusual emotional effects that are very different from, say, LSD or other psychedelics. And when MDMA first kind of appeared on the scene, it was used by therapists in things like couples therapy to help couples overcome issues, and it was used in people who had been traumatized by something, similar to PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, although at the time that diagnosis didn't exist. And so there's been these anecdotal reports that MDMA induces this state of consciousness that's subtly different from ordinary consciousness, where people feel very open and safe. And so I've been trying to understand what exactly is going on there. And the story that's emerging is that for some reason, something that MDMA does to serotonin is decreasing people's concern about threats, so that people have less vigilance for threats, they have less anxiety, and they feel safer. And this might be something that could in some situations be very bad if you are in an unsafe situation, or it might be something that could be useful if you're in a particular other situation, such as in therapy.
Right.
We've been trying to measure that effect in a couple of different ways, having people try to recognize different emotional faces or look at the trustworthiness of different pictures of people, and we are seeing significant effects. So it seems like MDMA is doing something to the fear response and decreasing it.
I think that's really interesting that there's some kind of an effect that the serotonergic system is linked into the fear system in a down regulating way, turning it down.
Well, that's something that I have to confess I still don't quite understand, because there's still studies, or there's studies that on the one hand seem to indicate that increasing serotonin increases some aspects of paying attention to potential threats. And then there's other studies that indicate that increasing serotonin seems to decrease these things. And so serotonin is still a very paradoxical thing. And probably part of the truth is that it's being used in different parts of the brain for different purposes, or that changes in serotonin levels over different time frames have different meanings.
Right.
And so it's something that science is still trying to tease out.
And then there's also threshold effects. So different concentrations of the drug in your system may have different effects depending on, you know, how large it is. I know they're very different metabolic responses to different levels of different drugs depending on what they are.
Absolutely. And so this is something that in humans, we only have relatively indirect ways of trying to understand what's happening in the brain. And so a lot of what we do in our group is we give multiple drugs at once in order to block certain receptors or certain binding sites for drugs. And so one of the experiments that we're doing right now is looking at combinations of citalopram, which is an SSRI antidepressant. And so it blocks the serotonin transporter, and it's used as an antidepressant. And we're giving that along with MDMA to see which effects are changed if we block MDMA's ability to interact with the serotonin transporter. And so that's the way we try and understand things. But it's definitely one where it's indirect and inferential, and it will take some time before we can really be confident about our results and know what serotonin's doing.
There was a study, you sent me an abstract also, a recent study suggesting that MDMA may change levels of oxytocin as well, which is known to be the bonding hormone. And for the last couple of years, every Valentine's Day, there's a few stories about meadow voles and prairie voles and oxytocin and love. I think that's a really interesting story. Can you expand on that a bit?
Absolutely. So some serotonergic drugs increase oxytocin. Oxytocin is this hormone that was classically thought to be involved in things like childbirth and lactation. Although now there's really compelling evidence that it's also involved in bonding in mammals. So affiliation, and there's been a lot of speculation that it might be important for MDMA's effects, that maybe the reason MDMA has its unusual emotional effects is that it induces oxytocin release.
Right.
And a few years back, we saw some really nice evidence from rodents that this was quite possibly true. And a group in the Netherlands has published some data showing that MDMA does increase oxytocin in the blood, and that this is quite possibly related to the social effects. And in our own lab, we also see similar things where we've measured oxytocin in the blood after MDMA. MDMA definitely increases oxytocin. And we did a statistical mediation analysis to look at how the oxytocin levels might be related to these feelings of increased sociability and extroversion. And it does seem like if you're trying to understand how friendly people feel on MDMA, just knowing that they took MDMA is useful. But if you can also measure their oxytocin, you'll be much better at predicting how friendly they're feeling. So that's a mediation analysis. And
so
it does seem likely that oxytocin is important for this. Although the really crucial experiment would be if somebody could block the oxytocin receptor in humans and show that you don't get these sorts of unusual emotional effects. But no one's done that yet. And there's another problem with just looking in the blood with oxytocin, which is that oxytocin levels in the brain and the blood may be very different. And so
right. So
we are seeing good evidence that oxytocin is important, but I would say it's 90% certain, but not 100%.
That's always one of the hardest things with these neuropsychological studies, neuropsychopharmacological studies, is being able to link what's happening in the brain with what's happening in the blood, with what's happening at the psychological level and the behavioral level. So being able to put all these things together, I mean, until you can actually physically watch a molecule a transmitter or a hormone binding with a receptor in the brain and then, you know, causing a signal that actually elicits a behavior. Until you can actually physically watch all that happening, it's all correlation.
Absolutely. And it's frustrating right now in the sense that we have exquisite data on how, say, LSD or MDMA affects cells or brain slices. And we have some pretty good data on how it feels to be on one of these drugs. Mm-hmm. But somehow connecting the two is a real big challenge. And it's still quite mysterious why, you know, why MDMA, which releases serotonin and norepinephrine and has some downstream effects on dopamine and acetylcholine, why should those changes cause you to feel this way? There's no real simple definite answer yet. And we're reduced to hand waving.
We'll see. I'm interested in seeing if somebody can come up with that way to link it, because it's been in all sorts of neuro research. It's a stumbling block for so many issues dealing with consciousness and the brain. You mentioned LSD, so I want to move on from MDMA and take a look at LSD and what we know about that. There's some interesting research suggesting that LSD might be good for cluster headaches, which seems
discovered because they were looking for a migraine remedy. Albert Hoffman was using ergot molds, rye molds.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't. I'm blanking on what exactly Hoffman was trying to do, but yeah, he certainly was doing research back in the 30s.
It was for a migraine remedy, as I remember. And ergots are used in migraine treatment, I thought, or ergot derivatives.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, it wouldn't be surprising if LSD ended up being somehow useful for headaches. The interesting thing here maybe we should back up and say that cluster headaches are not just any old headache. They're a particularly bad kind of headache. And those who study it say that it's possibly the worst kind of pain a human can experience. Oof. So people who suffer from cluster headaches and who've had other things will say that, oh yeah, childbirth without anesthesia, not as bad as a cluster headache. And so these are particularly painful ones. They're worse than migraines. And they're called cluster headaches because they essentially come in clusters. They have a cyclical pattern where they might occur at the same time each day or the same day each week. And so they may go on for a while and then they may stop, with the particular pattern varying from person to person. And they're just extraordinarily painful and difficult to treat. And there's this group, Cluster Busters, which is a group of people that suffer from this problem, who got together to try and understand it better. And they realized that it seemed like hallucinogenic drugs like LSD or the drug psilocybin might be preventing or decreasing the headaches. And they got the interest of some researchers, John Halpern, who's at McLean Hospital, and Andrew Sewell, who's now at Yale. And they looked into this and got very nice evidence just from looking at retrospective data from these patients that it seemed like this might be useful. And the thing is, though, is that the doses that people were taking weren't necessarily psychoactive. And so in a way, this isn't really an issue with these with psychedelics curing headaches. It's more that these psychedelics happen to have some effect that we don't understand that are useful for headaches or may be useful.
Could it be related to vasodilation or something like that?
Or constriction.
Absolutely, because that's the hypothesized mechanism of these headaches, that you have that vasodilation that impinges on a nerve and causes the pain. And so it's probably something to do with that, but exactly why these drugs do it is not yet clear. And it's starting to seem, although there haven't been really good publications yet, there's been some reports that maybe some non-psychedelic compounds that are closely related to LSD might also work. And so this has got a lot of potential to help a lot of people that are really suffering a lot.
And aside from this potential clinical development, do we know how LSD causes hallucinations, how these psychoactive drugs like psilocybin and LSD actually work to make us hallucinate.
Well, we do know that all these, what we might call classical hallucinogens or classical serotonergic hallucinogens, drugs like LSD, work by stimulating a particular type of serotonin receptor, which we call the 5-HT2A receptor. And this serotonin receptor is probably, although it's distributed throughout the brain, probably the important ones are the ones that are in the cortex. And as far as we understand what this receptor does, it seems to be doing something like changing the relationship between the input and output of the neuron. So if you think of neurons as maybe doing some kind of computation, mm-hmm. they're taking in information and somehow computing and summing it up and then giving a result. And the LSD mm-hmm. seems to be doing something like changing the sensitivity of the neurons so that they're more likely or more ready to give their output. Now, why exactly that causes these sorts of states is, you know, as I said earlier, it's kind of mysterious. And it's one possibility that the visual effects are essentially something like spontaneous pattern formation, where if you have a increased level of excitability in a system, you can sometimes get essentially standing waves to form. And it may be that to some extent, visuals from psychedelics are just something simple like that. But in terms of why people feel these profound changes in meaning and they feel like they're not quite themselves and they have these transcendent mystical experiences, that's still not well understood.
Yeah, that seems like it's something different, but probably linked, but different from just the hallucinations.
Absolutely. And it does seem that there are some drugs, some psychedelics that are very, very visual. You know, say mescaline, which is found in the cactus peyote, is a fairly visual psychedelic, whereas some other ones, some phenethylamines, DOM, is relatively less visual. And so you can still have these changes in meaning and these feelings of transcendence and have, you know, more or less of the visuals. So it's probable that the visuals are caused by some additional receptor or pathway. And there hasn't been a whole lot of research on that. David Nichols, in one of his review articles, hypothesized that the 5-HT1A receptor, a different serotonin receptor, might be important. And lately there's been a lot of evidence that a closely related receptor, the 5-HT1B, might be important for sensory processing in general. So that would be my current guess, but that's just a hypothesis.
I think these are all really interesting directions to go. You remember this last year, 2009, there was a video released, maybe it was 2008 at the end of last year, but the TED conference, Jill Bolt Taylor, she's written a book, Her Stroke of Insight, where this woman who's a neuroanatomist had a stroke and she ended up with this change in, you know, this feeling of connectedness and this feeling, you know, her entire perception of self was changed by her stroke, but that was a stroke. And so, with these drugs, I mean, is that a parallel pathway? Do you find any kind of similarity to the effect of the stroke versus, say, someone taking one of these psychoactive drugs?
In some ways, yes, and so. You could say that a lot of different conditions can cause you to sort of loosen your sense of yourself. And I think it's very useful to think of psychedelic drugs as having a liminal effect. So as placing you in a state where your sort of normal patterns and your normal sense of self are weakened. And the, you know, liminal state is an anthropological term, and it is something that would be used in, say, rituals where you transition into adulthood and things like that. And in these states, your sense of who you are is less than it normally is. And as a result, you can maybe come out of them into a new understanding of yourself. So in that way, I would say that a stroke and a psychedelic experience are somewhat similar. But on the other hand, these are very different mechanisms. And in one sense, you have, on the one hand, with strokes, you have frank damage to the brain. And with a psychedelic, you just have this altered state of consciousness that, you know, the major risks of it are almost certainly just behavioral ones or anxiety. So just basically you get scared and or you behave foolishly. So in that sense, they're sort of different.
Yeah, I'm just kind of thinking of the way that we look at medical symptoms. So infectious diseases, if you get dengue fever or malaria or, you know, the flu, there are all these symptoms that are the same. You're going to have a fever, you're going to have a headache, you're going to have, you know, and it's just a matter, all of the symptoms come out the same at the end. That's the underlying, the other underlying reason is completely different. And I think this seems a similar story to that. But I'm just wondering about the insights that can be gained from looking at both of these stories of how changes in consciousness occur, to kind of give us more understanding or a greater understanding of how consciousness occurs and what consciousness actually is.
I think that's a fascinating direction, absolutely. And a lot of the research that's been taking place with consciousness in science has either been very focused on the contents of consciousness and mostly visual awareness. So when you're seeing this thing, when you're aware of a certain thing versus aware of another thing, how is your brain different? So that's very specifically contents. And then there's a branch of research on consciousness that's been looking at anesthesia and what changes when your consciousness goes away. But we have not done a whole lot yet in terms of what's changed when your consciousness is altered in the way that psychedelics alter it, where you feel like you have more consciousness. And I think it's a really important direction for science to take. One of the things that seems to happen sometimes with these altered states is people have a loosening of their sense of their self. They may merge with the environment, and they may, as a result, just have a profound transformation in their understanding of themselves and their lives and, you know, what they want to do with their life. And this is something that we worry about in the sense of risks when we do experiments. And so when we do an experiment, part of it involves explaining to a potential participant what's going to happen in the study and what the risks will be and what benefits, if any. And we normally tell them, you're just doing a scientific experiment. There's no real benefits to you. We would like it to be useful to society, but that's uncertain. And one of the risks is that, you know, on MDMA, you might disclose more than you normally would to people and feel kind of foolish afterwards. And a risk with a psychedelic like LSD is that it could potentially cause some sort of change in somebody's life where they might see things new and decide to quit their job or do something different. And that's one of the reasons that in our experiments, we only use experienced people who've taken these drugs before on their own, because our hope is that those people, if they have some kind of possibility of making some big change in their life, have already done so if they're going to. And so
and you're not going to be the driving factor behind that.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, the whole do no harm. You know, it sounds very Star Trek to me. Are there any other... Go ahead.
And so I think that a really fascinating area with these drugs relating to consciousness is this mystical experience thing, which I've just started to allude to. And there was a wonderful study that was done at Johns Hopkins by Roland Griffiths and his colleagues, where he took 30-odd people who kind of had some sort of spiritual tendencies or practice already, and they had never used any psychedelics before, and he gave them psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in hallucinogenic mushrooms, and found that many people, I think approximately 60% of them, had a full-blown mystical experience, and that these experiences really had a lot of impact on the people. And as much as 14 months afterwards, most of them were still saying that these experiences were among the top five, or in some cases, the top most meaningful, important experience in their life.
Wow.
And so, this is something where it really can change people's lives, and it could hopefully do it for the better, but it won't necessarily always be the case.
Right. Change, you never know which direction change is going to happen in.
So that group argues that we could start to use these substances for induction of mystical experiences in laboratory settings to try and understand what the mystical experience is and what its mechanism is in the brain. They're very careful in the way they talk about this and think about it to avoid saying that the drugs are causing the experience, more that they're somehow facilitating them or making them more likely. And so they've been able to strike an interesting balance between doing science, but also being very respectful for the fact that these substances have traditionally in many cultures been used in what we would consider a religious context. And certainly in this country, the Native American church uses peyote, which contains mescaline, in a sacred way. And there's recently been advances in ayahuasca using religions in this country, and ayahuasca religions are legal and accepted in other countries. And so that's a really interesting direction that I think may have a lot of impact on our culture, which is that there may be increasing acceptance of the fact that some people are using these substances in a very serious religious manner, and that it's, you know, not just something that is sort of flippant recreational drug use where people are trying to get high,
right?
But people have all kinds of reasons for taking these.
Yeah, I wonder if there are, do you know if there are any studies that find a link between these drug-induced mystical religious experiences and, say, meditation-induced religious experiences, or, you know, there are religions all over the world where people say they've had some kind of a mystical experience. But is there any kind of common thread between all of the things that initiate them?
Well, from the phenomenological level, what they feel like, it doesn't seem like there's necessarily differences based on the trigger. And so different contexts can lead to having what seems like a very similar experience, at least in to the extent that we've been able to measure these experiences. And so there's one questionnaire that's commonly used in this sort of research that has been used for different experiences that are produced in different settings or have different triggers, and they seem pretty similar. Although I have to say there is an argument in people that study seriously different religions about how similar mystical experiences are in different religious traditions. And there are those who are sort of the Joseph Campbell school who say, yeah, it's all kind of similar in different religions. I have different takes on a kind of common underlying experience. And then there are those who say, no, you can't know that, and they may actually be really different. And there's something essentially unknowable about this really special internal experience.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things, the questions, one of the driving forces between wanting to study this stuff also is wanting to understand the unknowable experience, wanting to figure it out and know why it happens. Is there, as we're looking at all of these drugs, you know, you're looking at LSD and finding that maybe it's smaller doses or a certain aspect of the chemical that leads to therapeutic responses in cluster headaches. In ketamine, it looks as though there might be therapeutic uses for depression, but maybe it's not just ketamine. Maybe it's some other, you know, acting on a particular receptor. And like you said, with MDMA, there are negative physiological effects that maybe go along with the psychological effects. And if we can, as we look at this, are people starting to try and find the specific triggers that lead to these responses? And is there going to be a time when, you know, maybe people won't be taking these illicit drugs, but they'll actually be taking targeted drugs meant for a very specific therapeutic effect?
I think that that's very likely. And in some ways, there's tension between two kinds of possibilities. One possibility is traditions in which people take, say, psychoactive cacti like peyote. Mm-hmm. And or ayahuasca. And in those sorts of traditions, the things that I would call a negative effect, like, you know, vomiting, upset stomach.
Yeah,
are,
not so nice.
Right. But within these particular contexts, those are seen as being meaningful and they're part of a purification. And so they're not necessarily seen as being bad.
Right.
And so there's the one sort of school where you find meaning in these things. And then on the other hand, there's sort of the more traditional pharmaceutical approach, which is try and find a way to decrease these negative things and increase the positive things. Mm-hmm. And I think it's definitely true that we are going to understand better the toxic elements of drugs like MDMA and the non-toxic elements and be able to separate them out. One of the things that some people experience with MDMA are negative after effects, where they might have increased anxiety or decreased mood or irritability or difficulty concentrating for maybe a day or two after MDMA. Sometimes it's the next day. Sometimes it happens 2 or 3 days after they take it. This isn't really well studied, but there are some indications that we're seeing in an ongoing study that it may be possible to separate that aspect of MDMA from mm-hmm. the acute effects, where you might be able to have an intervention after the acute effects of MDMA have more or less ended that would then prevent these next day effects. And this is something that people have anecdotally reported just out there in the world, but it seems like there may be some truth to that.
I think this is really just a fascinating, fascinating topic. And I keep looking at literature and looking at the news, and people are talking so much about, people using Adderall and other pharma drugs that, you know, it's not the typical drug use. It's drug use people are self-administering to focus better at work, to get an edge, to be able to do better in their work lives. And I can't help but imagine that there are going to be more and more targeted drugs that that maybe people are going to get prescriptions to be able to, you know, study for finals or, you know, whatever it turns into. And that maybe some of these drugs might end up being lumped into that new future brand of future self-medication.
Yeah, it really is a brave new world. And we as a society have to understand the possibilities here and come to some sort of decision as to, is this okay or not? And right now, you know, people taking Adderall in order to do better on their finals is something that's kind of in a gray area where many people are really opposed to it and other people say, oh, you know, it's fine. And we don't really have a consensus either, you know, socially or...
We should mention that Adderall is basically methamphetamine, and given the effects of methamphetamine, it's probably a bad idea. But there you go.
That's a good
it's
thing.
It's amphetamine salts. It's, you know, it's...
Absolutely. Although on the other hand, amphetamine is an important part of the possibility space of treatments for various things. So for some people who have ADHD and...
I was on Adderall for several years. Very low doses. Nothing that would help you study. Unless you were ADD. If you're ADD, it would help.
It absolutely would help.
So.
And so in the same way that we are now faced with this question of, well, is it going to be okay for people to take amphetamine or modafinil in order to think better? Mm-hmm. We're also going to be faced with the question of if people find that some future psychedelic drug helps them to understand themselves better or their place in their world or just helps them to understand life, you know, is that okay? And right now we have some narrowly carved out exceptions where we're allowing that in certain religious ways with the Native American church or with ayahuasca churches. But it's certainly not something that the general population is allowed to do. And so this is one of these things that society is going to need to address.
There's probably a lot to be said for having a long tradition and, you know, a lot of support. As we know, set and setting is real important with these psychoactives. I mean, I think the real problem is big. They get used recreationally in pretty unpredictable settings.
In unpredictable settings, and you don't know what's going to happen, and there are unpredictable effects. And I think the issue is, you know, people are worried about other people, and people want other people to have, you know, a healthy life and to have interactions with other people that are healthy and not, you know, just based on a substance.
I don't want to love you just because I took MDMA.
Right. Yeah. You don't want something that's not real. We don't want life to turn into something that's just based on pharmaceuticals or.
But clearly the first step is to do this research.
Right.
Figure out what the hell's going on.
Right.
Is it just, you know, an illusion? Is it real? Is it, you know. And, you know, I think you've got to understand the mechanism before you can do anything else.
Yeah, and when you come at this question, I mean, it does at one point, I think, break down to, as a reductionist neuroscientist myself, it all breaks down to the chemicals in your brain and the electrical signals that are being sent. And so whether it's from a plant, whether it's from a pill, whether it's from your food, you know,
we drug ourselves all the time with carbohydrates. You know, that's not illegal.
Exactly. And so I think Matt, you're absolutely right. This is something I'm really glad that you and other researchers like you are doing this research, because it's something that society is going to bump up against as the pharmaceutical industry develops more and more drugs that are targeted to specific purposes, as drug use continues in our country and around the world, which it's going to. Mm-hmm. And so these are questions that we as a country, that we as a world are going to have to ask ourselves. What is okay? What do we accept and what do we not accept and why? And are we going to be hypocritical about things? I think you raise
Absolutely.
A great point.
And so I think that we definitely need to think about this, and we also need more research to understand what these drugs are doing. And so with that in mind, I just want to mention that while there's a lot of wonderful research that's being supported by the NIH, by our tax dollars, mm-hmm. some of the research that's really focused on whether these drugs might be useful as medicine is being funded privately by organizations such as the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS, and the Hefter Research Institute and the Beckley Foundation. And so these are organizations that your listeners can go out and find on the web if they're interested in supporting this sort of research. Because right now, the funding priorities of the NIH are very appropriately focused on trying to help people who are sick and who have diseases. And the money has to be spent in a fairly conservative way. And while psychedelic research has some promise as medicine, certainly it's something that's still kind of out there for NIH. And so there needs to be more research done with private funding before the NIH is ever going to fund something like using MDMA to help cure post-traumatic stress disorder or using LSD to cure cluster headaches.
Right. Well, I thank you very much. This has been a really,
really
interesting discussion.
Yeah.
It's neat to hear about. We just hear so much negativity and just awful things about drugs in the news. And it's just nice to hear that there's research being done and that there are people working to understand how and the why behind the things that people are taking and what's happening, and this is going to help our world. If you are interested in more information on this subject, you can visit Matt's website. He administrates psychedelicresearch.org. You can visit his blog, and he updates it regularly with research that's coming out in this area. It's a fascinating research resource. I think it's great. And if you are interested in hearing more Dr. Kiki Science Hour, you can come back next week.
There's always more.
There's always more. Right now I'm working on getting an interview with a NASA researcher on the Cassini mission to Saturn for next week. So hopefully that'll be a wonderful, wonderful interview for next week.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it'll be fun. Let's go. Let's take drugs and then fly to outer space.
Not at the same time. Thank you, Matthew. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. This has been great.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Dr. Kiki. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, and you can download Dr. Kiki Science Hour from iTunes if you want to find it, if you've just tuned in live. We are in iTunes, and you can find past episodes of Dr. Kiki Science Hour on twit.tv/Kiki. We're hopefully going to change that to DKSH at some point. And you can find me online at drkiki.tv or at Dr. Kiki on Twitter. And if you need more sciencey goodness, you can listen to This Week in Science, which can be found at twists.org. And I'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Peace out.
That's appropriate.